Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did James Madison shape America's future beyond his contributions to the Constitution and Bill of Rights? As my guest today will explain, the man who would serve as the fourth president of the United States helped to establish not only the law on which this country was founded, but the workings of its politics, from the party system to a reverence for the value of public opinion to the savvy media strategies sometimes required to influence those opinions. Richard Brookhiser is senior editor of the National Review. He tells Madison's story in his new biography called simply James Madison. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it struck me reading this book that James Madison would feel entirely at home operating in the world of 21st century national politics, and yet there was a lot about him that would have made him almost unelectable in the modern world of electronic media.
Well, you know, those things were roadblocks to him in his own day.
Mm-hmm.
He was the son of a wealthy Virginia planter, so that's definitely in the plus side. He didn't have to worry about where his next meal was coming from, ever. But he was a short man. He was a little over 5 feet tall. He was very slight. He was not much over 100 pounds. He was plagued by ill health all his life and by worries over ill health. He was both a hypochondriac and he was actually sick a lot.
That's a bad combination.
Bad combination. He was painfully shy. If he knew everybody in the room, he was great. He was smart. He was funny. He told stories. But if there was one stranger, he just clammed up. He simply clammed up. And yet, this rather unprepossessing man was able to befriend important, powerful people and then become president of the United States himself. And he was always able to screw himself up to perform a political task, however uncongenial it was. I'll just mention one, which is public debating. Another drawback he had. His voice was weak and unpleasant. Someone described it as croaking. And yet, this man at the Virginia Ratifying Convention to ratify the Constitution in the summer of 1788, he went head-to-head with Patrick Henry day after day after day. Patrick Henry is the greatest orator in the United States at that time. Of the Constitution. But Madison is the leader of the pro-Constitution forces in Virginia, and he just went head-to-head with Patrick Henry in public debates at this ratifying convention. Now, he didn't try to beat him on fireworks. Mm-hmm. You know, no one was going to do that. If it was fireworks, Patrick Henry is always going to win. But the way Madison beat him is time and again he would say, well, right now, we're debating Article 2, Section 3, so let's look at Article 2, Section 3, which says, you know, whatever it says, and here's why it says it. He was constantly pulling Henry back to the subject, and it was that sort of relentless persistence that enabled him to win in an uncongenial format.
You know, we have such reverence today, Richard, for the Constitution, even as we continue to debate what the framers meant. It's hard to imagine a time when a lot of people thought we did not need this document. Can you talk a little bit about how it became clear that the Articles of Confederation would not be enough and why Patrick Henry and many in his camp thought that we didn't need the Constitution?
Well, it's a two-part problem. There are the problems with the Articles, which I think most of the political class in this country thought were overwhelming by the mid to late 1780s. Pretty much everybody thought that the Articles were too ineffectual a system, that they didn't allow the government of the United States to do things it had to be able to do. One of these was taxation. Under the Articles of the Confederation, the Continental Congress could not raise taxes. They could make requests to the states. It was called requisitions upon the states. And the states could pay or not pay as they decided, either because they didn't want to or because they were too strapped, which was also often the case. So people saw that as a major problem. But once the Constitution is written and it emerges from Philadelphia in September of 1787, a lot of people thought that they had bungled the job. You know, they were willing to take a new Constitution and even a stronger one, but they had real problems with the Constitution they were presented. And one of the main ones was that there was no Bill of Rights in the Constitution. Now, that had barely come up at the whole Constitutional Convention. It was only raised as a topic for discussion at the tail end of it. And by then, everybody was tired. They wanted to get home. And Roger Sherman of Connecticut said, look, all the states have their own bills of rights. You know, why do we need to have one for the nation as a whole? And so they let it drop. But once the Constitution left Philadelphia and went before the states for ratification, and it needed 9 states to go into effect, 9 of the original 13. There was real alarm all across the country that there was no Bill of Rights in this new Constitution. And Madison, the role he plays in all of this, is he changes his mind over the course of the debates. I mean, he was not hot to stick a Bill of Rights in the Constitution himself. He was perfectly fine with it not having one. But he sees in state after state that this comes up as a question, that people are very disturbed about it, they're very passionate about it. He's also getting letters from his best friend, Thomas Jefferson, who is out of the country. He's in Paris. He's America's ambassador to France. And Madison is keeping him briefed about everything that's going on. And Jefferson writes back, numerous letters. And every single letter, Jefferson says, many nice things in the Constitution, you know, like it a lot, you guys did a good job, but it really does need a Bill of Rights. That's something that every people deserves from every government. So with this double process, Madison changes his mind. This is an interesting quality of him. He is able to change his mind and adapt himself to overwhelming circumstances if they require it. And so by the time the Constitution is ratified at the end of 1788, and then the new government goes into effect, James Madison is a congressman from Virginia in the first Congress, and he makes it his business to put a Bill of Rights on the agenda of the House of Representatives. And he shepherds what would become the first 10 amendments through the House. The Senate makes its own changes on them, and then they go off to the states, and they're ratified in short order. And that's really a kind of a union of the two opposite sides in this contest. The winners conceded to the losers that they did, in fact, have a point about a Bill of Rights, and they added a Bill of Rights to the Constitution.
So talk about the Federalist Papers, which Madison worked on with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay to sort of convince the American people of the importance of this new Constitution. First of all, what was the division of labor among them for the things that were contained within the Federalist Papers?
Well, Jay drops out very early. He gets rheumatoid arthritis. He's the oldest of the three authors. But he only ends up writing 5 of the 85 papers overall. So the lion's share of the work falls on Hamilton and Madison. And it's just frantic. I mean, when Madison was an old man, he wrote a reminiscence of what it was like churning these things out. They're about 2,000 words long. An op-ed page today typically is 750 words, So they're over twice as long as a typical op-ed piece. They were running 4 times a week in New York City newspapers. And the pace, it must have been just insane. And he says, you know, when we started off, we would show, you know, I would show Hamilton would show me drafts of what we had written, but it just became impractical to do it because the tempo was so quick and so punishing. So they just start, you know, churning out their stuff, and they trust each other enough to, you know, let the other one go off and do his thing. The way the Division of Labor works out is that Madison writes most of the papers on Congress. And his big chunk of them, he starts with Federalist 10. That's when he gets on board on the project. And then he goes up through Federalist 62 or 63. Not all of those. He writes 29 papers in that stretch. But most of his have to do with Congress and the powers of Congress. And his great insight, I think, in the Federalist Papers, it kind of culminates in number 51, where he makes the case that the very complications of the new Constitution are a bulwark of liberty.
Hmm.
The fact that you have a president and a judiciary and two houses of Congress, which are chosen in different ways, and that all of these are coexisting alongside 13 states, in a way he embraces the gridlock. He says this is a good thing, because this means that a malign faction will find it almost impossible to take power over the whole country. And his great phrase in Federalist 51 is, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. So all these office holders, they each have, you know, their own office and their own different branch of government. They're going to be very protective of that, because that's, you know, that's where their reputations are going to be made, where their power flows from. That's a good thing, because they will all work to keep their colleagues and comrades in their own places. So that's his sort of great insight. Now, Hamilton writes a lot more about foreign policy. He writes more about the judiciary and more about the executive. And Hamilton writes the phrase, energy in the executive is the first quality of good government. And that will be a seed of later disagreements between these two friends.
What was the source of Madison's early discomfort with the idea of what he called factions, or what we today call political parties?
Well, everybody shared it. Everybody had a notion that, you know, parties, they were suspicious of them. They looked at history and they saw parties as sources of actual strife in early republics. And, they looked at the Greek city-states, the Roman Republic, Italian city-states in the Renaissance. And there's a lot of chaos and confusion. And they see parties as the source of that, and or factions. And so they, you know, there's a kind of a notion that they're a bad thing. Madison knows they're inevitable. He writes that in Federalist 10. But he almost has an attitude of like a scientist in white gloves dealing with germs. You know, he knows he's not going to get rid of these things, but you have to be very careful. He is going to change his mind on that as we get into the 1790s and as he starts drifting away and then turning on Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, what was there one thing that caused their falling out?
Hamilton's success. His success in getting a financial program, which Madison found just alien and incomprehensible and threatening. Hamilton is a former merchant's clerk from the West Indies. Madison is a Virginia gentleman planter. And so Hamilton feels he's trying to move the United States into a new financial world. Madison just feels this is alien and unacceptable. But, you know, less important than the details of that fight, although that's a very far-reaching fight, what was interesting to me in this book is what Madison did about it, and that launches him in a very creative phase of his career politically.
Well, you have set us up beautifully for this break we're about to take, followed by the next segment of the program. My guest this hour is Richard Brookhiser. He's senior editor of the National Review and author of the new book, James Madison.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're
listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd.
My guest this hour is Richard Brookhiser. He's senior editor of the National Review and author of the new book, James Madison. So Madison and Alexander Hamilton have this disagreement over the financial future of the country and the way the economy should be structured. And so Madison in 1791 takes what appears, at least initially, to be a vacation with his old buddy Thomas Jefferson.
That's right. They go, they leave Philadelphia, which is the capital, and they go to New York City, and then they go to upstate New York all the way to Lake George, and then they cut over to Vermont and start going south in New England, and then to Long Island, and then back to New York City. And they, you know, they fish for trout, and they canoe on lakes, and Jefferson writes his daughter Polly a letter on a piece of birch bark, you know. So they're doing their woodland thing. But Hamilton gets a letter from a friend of his in New York City named Robert Troup, who tells him there is every appearance of a passionate courtship between Madison and Jefferson and local New York politicians who have their own problems with Alexander Hamilton. Hmm. So what they're up to is they're collecting allies. And Madison is very alarmed by Hamilton's financial program. So is Jefferson, his dear friend, fellow Virginian. But you can't just have a one-state opposition. You've got to have allies across the country. And this is what they're starting to collect with this trip to New York and New England. And they look elsewhere. They find allies in Pennsylvania as they go along. And, you know, I said before the break that Madison and other founders were very suspicious of parties or factions. So it takes them a while to really become conscious of what they're doing. But as early as 1792, Madison gives a name to this new alliance. He calls it the Republican Party. Now, it's the first Republican Party. It's no relation to today's GOP, and Madison's party will change its name to the Democratic Party in the early 1830s. This is the beginning of that party. It's the oldest political party in America, one of the oldest in the world. And this is an innovation that Madison and Jefferson are forming a national political party to try and get the government back on track. Second innovation of these two men is to have a partisan newspaper. This is called the National Gazette. It's published in Philadelphia. Madison finds the first editor. It's an old college buddy of his from Princeton named Philip Freneau. And Freneau has had kind of a miscellaneous career. He's writing poetry, and he's been a ship captain, and he's done this and that. But Madison approaches him to edit a newspaper. He introduces him to Jefferson, who gives him basically a no-show job in the State Department.
So he's got money. He doesn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I got a little salary. You know, he can keep going. But his main job is to be editing the National Gazette, in which he will thwack Hamilton and, soon enough, President Washington for what Madison and Jefferson considered to be their errors. So now, America had a very lively print culture throughout the 18th century. Lots of newspapers and almanacs and books and pamphlets, and many of these were quite political. But the National Gazette is the first party organ, and it's really the origin of political and ideological journalism as we experience it today. So that's another innovation. The third thing that Madison does, and this was maybe his most creative step, is to think about what he was doing and explain why he was doing it. And he writes a series of essays for Freneau's new newspaper, the National Gazette, and in them he touches on the importance of public opinion. He says every citizen must be a sentinel to watch over the rights of all. Now, why is that a new thing in 1791, 1792? A lot of the founders thought, they all believed in popular sovereignty, mm-hmm. that the people ruled. But most of them seemed to think that that would happen at elections. You know, the people would go to the polls, they'd vote, and then the office holders would you know, do their jobs until the next election, and then the people would either reelect them or get rid of them and put new guys in there.
So, like, get us elected, get us into office, and then trust us to do what you need.
Well, or, you know, let us do our jobs, and then you'll tell us whether we've done them well or not. But Madison is saying, no, this has to be 24/7. This is he doesn't say 24/7, but he says that this must be a continuous and an ongoing process. And he calls it public opinion. It's a very early use of that as a phrase. And this, in his mind, this is a new safeguard of liberty. He'd written about the safeguards that were in the Constitution in the Federalist Papers. But it turns out those weren't enough, because Hamilton had surmounted them. You know, all the safeguards of the Constitution that were supposed to prevent alien, strange things like Hamilton's financial plan hadn't worked. He'd gotten his financial plan anyway. So there had to be something else. And what that something else was modern politics, and it was based on an attention to public opinion. Now, the dark side here is Madison is saying it's attending to public opinion. That can also be manipulating it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would say leading it, shaping it, enlightening it. And it's a dialogue. I mean, he is explicit about that. The people are talking to their leaders. The leaders are talking to the people. But, you know, you can see how manipulation can take its place in this system, and we certainly understand that today looking around us. But in Madison's defense, what are the alternatives? I mean, the alternatives could be passivity or anarchy. I mean, public opinion and politics based on it is a way of steering between those two pitfalls.
So Hamilton was obviously a smart guy, and he turned around and did very similar things on his side of things. He started a party. He had his own newspaper.
Well, yes, and one of the ironies of their great fight, which occupies the whole decade of the 1790s, is that Hamilton wins more of the battles. He's actually a better journalist and a publicist and polemicist than Madison is. Journalism is really in his blood, and he's really better at it. But Madison wins the war, and that's at least in part because Madison understands it is a war, and he understands the battlefield and the battleground. He gets it better than Hamilton. Hamilton is always focusing on the details of the issues of the moment. Madison is kind of able to step back and look at the larger struggle and see that the battle over public opinion is what's going to decide this whole thing. And by the end of the 1790s, Hamilton's party has made enough mistakes and enough blunders. Madison and Jefferson and their party, the Republican Party, are able to take advantage of them. And in the presidential election of 1800, it's Thomas Jefferson who becomes the third president, and his Secretary of State will be his devoted old friend, James Madison.
And, of course, an important project they worked on together during Jefferson's term was the Louisiana Purchase. Can you talk about their goals for westward expansion and how and why they did it the way they did it?
Right. The Louisiana Purchase was the great example of it, but the principle at work here is expansion.
Mm-hmm.
These men had their eyes turned westward. I mean, Madison was looking westward when he was in his 20s in the Continental Congress during the Revolutionary War. Before we'd even won the Revolutionary War, before we were even an independent country, Madison is already thinking, how are we going to become a bigger country, and how are we going to move west? He always had his heart set on getting the Mississippi River. When Jefferson is now president, Madison's Secretary of State, the Mississippi and New Orleans at its head, and the whole Louisiana Territory had been owned by Spain for much of the 18th century. But in 1800, Napoleon made Spain give it to him. So now France has it. And their first plan, Jefferson and Madison, is to approach the French and say, look, we want New Orleans and we want the Florida Panhandle, and we're prepared to pay $10 million for that. And our diplomat in Paris is Robert Livingston. He's he's not really getting anywhere, so they send James Monroe, a Virginian friend of theirs, over to help him. And then all of a sudden, Napoleon lets it be known that he will give them New Orleans and the whole Louisiana Territory for $15 million. Mm. Now, Jefferson has a constitutional scruple. It's interesting. Does the Constitution permit him to do this without an amendment? And then Madison and everybody else says, look, you got to grab this or Napoleon's going to change his mind. So they pay the $15 million, and America essentially doubles in size without firing a shot.
Was that money just lying around, or where did they get $15 million?
We had cut taxes and cut spending, so Jefferson was being very prudent in his financial policy. So he had money. He was able to borrow money because our credit was good. We were able to raise a loan from Barings Bank in London. And so that's how we were able to make the purchase.
So let's talk a little bit about Madison's personal life, because you argue here that Dolly Payne Madison, was in fact the first political wife. Madison married her relatively late in his life.
Yes, and I think that's part of his shyness. He had fallen in love once before with a much younger woman named Kitty Floyd. He was in his late 20s, and she was only 15 going on 16. But she, they looked like they were engaged, but then she married a younger guy, so that didn't work. But then in his 40s, he meets Dolly Payne Todd, who is a younger woman, but she's a widow. She's already been married. And she's had two children, one of whom has survived a yellow fever epidemic. So she's a more worldly, more mature person than his first love. She writes a charming letter to one of her girlfriends early on in the courtship. She says, "The great little Madison is coming to see me tonight." So, and that's, he's little because he is. That's his stature. But she sees his intellectual and his political clout. So she's very thrilled by that, too. Now, what she does for him is that she is the extrovert. He never stops being a shy man. But he doesn't have to worry about it now, because he's married this great hostess. She's an attractive woman. She's a very flashy, stylish woman. She loves parties. She loves to throw parties. There's a moment later in her life where Henry Clay says to her, "Everybody loves Mrs. Madison." And she comes back and says, "That's because Mrs. Madison loves everybody."
Hmm.
It's like air kissing, She didn't love everybody. I mean, she knew who her husband's enemies were, and she kept score. But, she would rather like you than dislike you. And that was part of her personality. And this helps Madison establish himself in Washington, D.C. when he's Secretary of State and Jefferson's heir apparent.
Is it your sense that he was looking as much for that sort of companion as for someone to fall in love with when he chose her?
Oh, I think it was the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The way you put it makes it sound a little
calculating.
Mm-hmm. No, I think she sounds like she was just a delightful person. Just a delightful person. And everybody really did love her. So I'm sure that's what was going on his side of it.
How politically aware was she? Did she try to influence his opinion on things?
No. But she just, she knew where everybody stood. She knew who his friends were and who his not-so-friends were. And she was capable of doing ill turns to the latter. So she was a pretty savvy person, as well as being, lovely and charming.
So we have fought the War of Independence, and then things start getting bad with the British once again. Talk about the things that led up to the War of 1812 and what made the violations of our rights so untenable.
Well, the background here is that shortly after the French Revolution in 1789, we have almost 25 years of world war between France and virtually everybody else in Europe, but primarily Britain. Mm-hmm. And this is longer than World War One and World War Two put together. It's as violent as those wars. It's as ideological as the Cold War. It is an all-consuming struggle. And the two superpowers are Britain and France. The United States is a small, neutral country across the Atlantic Ocean. Now, both of these superpowers want to drag us into their orbit, and they bully us. They bully our shipping. They impose commercial regulations to try and get us to trade less with the enemy power. But the fact is, Britain is the premier naval power in the world, and Britain is a neighbor because it owns Canada, which is to our north. So they have many more opportunities to annoy us than France has, and they do. They harass our shipping. They will stop American ships on the high seas to look for British nationals in the crews, and if they find them, they yank them off and conscript them into their own navy. Hmm. They try to prevent us from trading with France. Governors General of Canada are conniving with Indians who live in the western part of the United States and seeing what trouble they can stir up there. So there's a lot going on. And for years at the beginning of the 19th century, Jefferson and Madison swallow it. They don't like it, but they swallow it because they don't want to go to war. They think war is a bad thing. It's expensive. It gets people frantic. It curtails rights. But by 1812, towards the end of Madison's first term, he feels he's just had enough. It can't keep going on. And in June 1812, he asks Congress to declare war on Britain, and it does.
Richard Brookhiser is my guest. He's senior editor of the National Review and author of the new book, James Madison.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Richard Brookhiser. He's senior editor of the National Review and author of the new book, James Madison. Richard, how militarily ready for the War of 1812 was the United States?
Hardly at all. We had a pretty good Navy. The Army was just in lousy shape. Winfield Scott, who would be one of our great generals in the early half of the 19th century. He got his start in the War of 1812, and years later he wrote his memoirs. So he thought back to what the Army was like in those days. And he said the officer corps was ignoramuses and imbeciles. the Secretary of the Army had been an Army surgeon in the Revolution. That was his only military experience. And he was incapable of administering. Someone described him as spending all his time looking at ads to see where he could buy 200 shoes or 100 hats. And the Secretary of the Navy was a drunk who quit work at noon every day. So, and now, why did these men have their jobs? They had their jobs for political reasons. Here is maybe a downside of Madison being such an adept politician. Well, he picked these guys for political reasons within the dynamics of his own party, and they were loyal as politicians. They were just lousy secretaries of war and secretaries of the Navy. And the first 6 months of the War of 1812 were just disastrous. The British conquered Detroit. We tried to invade Canada across the Niagara frontier in western New York. The New York militia would not cross the border. They said that we only have to serve within New York State. We can't go over to Canada. So that, that's a failure. We had some victories at sea. Those were the only good moments in the whole first 6 months. So then Madison has to try and make things better. And to his credit, he fires these bad secretaries that he had. He gets an excellent Secretary of the Navy and a much better Secretary of the Army. They clean out the dead wood. They start promoting better, younger officers like Winfield Scott. 1813, there's a lot of back and forth around Lake Ontario and northern New York, and it doesn't give anyone an advantage. But in Lake Erie, we win a naval battle in western part of Lake Erie in the fall of 1813. This is Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry, he's a kid, he's in his 20s. He beats a British fleet. This allows our flanks to be protected and our communications to be protected because we control the water. Remember, there are no roads out there in those days. So supplies, communications, it's all by the Great Lakes. Now that we control Lake Erie, we are able to invade Canada, and we are able to beat a British army and kill the Indian leader Tecumseh, who was probably the last American Indian leader who had the capability of stopping or slowing America's westward expansion. He was that talented. But we're able to kill him at a battle called the Battle of the Thames in late 1813. But then, as we get into 1814, Napoleon Bonaparte has lost, it seems. He is deposed as Emperor of France, and he's sent to essentially a prison on the island of Elba in the Mediterranean. He's the emperor now of the island of Elba. That's all he has left. So there's peace in Europe. And this means Britain can double its troop strength in North America in 1814. And so 1814, we're going to have a lot of rocky times.
This was also a very expensive war financially for the United States.
Well, it's $109 million ends up being the bill minus pensions for veterans, which, you know, in those days is quite a big chunk of money. It collapses our financial system. It simply collapses during the course of the war. We end up having to borrow money from a private banker, rich man in Philadelphia named Peter Girard. I mean, it's really a mess. The finances were just chaotic. But to Madison's credit, he's able to bull through all these problems and disasters. Maybe the most dramatic of them is that in 1814, the British burn Washington, D.C. He fights a battle. We fight a battle at Bladensburg, Maryland, which is on the edge of the District of Columbia. That's where the British are coming in. It's just a debacle. It was badly prepared, badly planned. The American troops flee. The British march into Washington. They leave private property alone for the most part, but they burn the Capitol. They burn the White House. And before they burn the White House, they finish Madison's dinner, which had been left on the table. And the British general makes lewd jokes about sitting in Dolly Madison's seat. But then when they're done with their meal, they burn the White House. The Madisons have had to flee. Then the British, they go on to try and take Baltimore, which is a much more important city than Washington, big port, and there they're defeated. They can't take the city. They can't take Fort McHenry, which guards the harbor. And, of course, this is where the Star-Spangled Banner is written by an American who is there to arrange a prisoner exchange, and he's on a British ship as the bombardment is taking place. And when it fails and the American flag is still flying the next day, this is when he writes what is now our national anthem.
So this is finally over in 1815.
Yes, Battle of New Orleans. Actually, the peace treaty had been signed before Christmas of 1814, but transatlantic communications were so slow that there was a British operation underway to attack the Gulf Coast, including New Orleans, and they didn't get the word. So there was this. The British made this disastrous frontal assault on a dug-in entrenchment with artillery that Andrew Jackson had set up south of the city, and their casualties were simply horrendous. I mean, 2,000 killed and wounded. The American killed and wounded were only 70. So that was this kind of spectacular defeat after the war was technically over. And I think, you know, we're coming up on the bicentennial of the War of 1812, and it's not a war that a lot of people know a lot about. And I think that's because Americans, they divide their past wars into the ones we like and then the ones we don't think about. Hmm. And the ones we like were either completely victorious or we think of them as inspiring in some way. The Civil War, World War II, the Revolutionary War. The War of 1812 is one of those semi-botched wars, and we don't like to think about it. But I think our recent experience of Iraq and Afghanistan maybe makes us uniquely able to look at the War of 1812, because in the War of 1812, a lot went wrong. There was a lot of lack of preparation. There were a lot of mistakes, a lot of bungles. But there was also a lot of learning. There was a lot of valor, and there was a lot of improvement in America's fighting over the course of the 2.5 years. And even though it's technically a draw by the time it ends, America is the smaller of the two countries, so we claim it as a victory with some reason.
What sort of post-presidential career did Madison have?
It was a pretty long one. He lived 19 years after he left office. And he kept his hand in. He followed politics. He gave people advice, including some of his successor presidents. I think his great failure was to come up with any creative ideas of how to deal with the problem of slavery. His only idea was Liberia, that American slaves might be freed and shipped to the coast of West Africa, which the country of Liberia is now there. And that was just a council of desperation. He was better off when he turned his thoughts to the possibility of secession. He could see that coming even in his lifetime. Some of the fights over the admission of Missouri into the Union in 1819, 1820, fights over the tariff in the late 1820s, early 1830s, these were clashes between the North and South, which were also clashes over the status of slavery. And Madison saw very clearly that this could break the country up, and he thought that that would be a disaster. And he said that anyone who proposed disunion, he compared such a person to Pandora opening her box or to the serpent creeping into paradise. So he sort of sees Fort Sumter coming 16 years before it does, and he warns against it.
Was anyone listening at that point?
Yes, some people were. Some people were. In fact, he wrote a letter for a Massachusetts congressman named Edward Everett attacking some early proto-secessionist arguments. And Everett goes on to give the main speech at Gettysburg. Of course, you know, Lincoln's speech is the more famous one, but the main orator that day was Edward Everett. So there was some continuity between the end of Madison's life and some of the people who survived into the Civil War.
What was established, what ideas were established in Madison's Republican Party that found their way into what today is known as the Democratic Party?
I think the main continuity, because, you know, the constituencies of the two parties have changed mm-hmm. many times over the years. There are just not a lot of slave owners in the Democratic Party anymore.
Thank
Almost
God for
none,
that.
I would
yeah.
say. But the main continuity, I think, is fear of a certain kind of money man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it goes right back to Hamilton and his banker friends. Now, not that James Madison and Thomas Jefferson were poor. I mean, they weren't. They were wealthy planters. But somehow getting your money from the soil made it good, whereas getting your money from, you know, speculation, mm-hmm. from dealing in currency, that seems pretty bad. And, you know, that marches right on today.
But Madison did come around to the idea of the need for a national bank.
Yes, he did. And that was, a lot of that was the influence of his Treasury Secretary, Albert Gallatin, a Swiss immigrant to this country, brilliant man. And he disagreed with Hamilton's objectives, but he thought that the national bank that Hamilton had set up was a very good financial institution. He thought it was well designed and well run, and Hamilton had been honest, and you know, he hadn't cut any corners. So he wanted to keep that going as a tool of governmental policy and monetary policy. It had a 20-year charter. It was founded in 1791. It was going to come up for renewal in 1811. And by then, Madison has agreed with Gallatin. He's for recharter, but he doesn't really come out swinging for it. And I think, you know, he's partly inhibited by the fact that he'd argued against the bank when it was first proposed. So Gallatin carries all the water on this issue, and it's defeated by the closest of margins. The House waits on the Senate. The Senate votes a tie. The vice president, who's the president of the Senate, Vice President George Clinton, casts a no vote, and so the First Bank of the United States goes down.
How concerned was Madison about his legacy as president?
Oh, he was very concerned with his legacy, and even more as father of the Constitution, mm-hmm. I would say, than president. Because in Philadelphia, in that summer of 1787, Madison attends every session of the Constitutional Convention. He sits himself by the head table so he can hear everybody who speaks, and he takes notes on every speech and every motion. And then, you know, at night he writes up any shorthand that he's written. He expands all his shorthand. And his set of notes is the most complete left by any of the delegates at the Constitutional Convention, and historians have mined that ever since. Now, Madison knew he had a little gold mine there, and he never released them during his lifetime. He knew they'd have more impact if he kept them until after his death. And in fact, he is the last signer of the Constitution, or the last attender of the Philadelphia Convention, to die. He dies in 1836. So his notes are finally printed in 1840, and this is really the physical or the objective form of his legacy that he leaves the world.
Richard Brookhiser is senior editor of the National Review. His new biography is called James Madison. Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.